Make your next move with a beautiful website from our sponsor, Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANBOOKS to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. Today we're going to meet up with the Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid, whose latest novel, Exit West, deals with one of the issues, arguably the issue of our time, the global movement of people. You'll notice I haven't called it the refugee crisis, and that's partly because for all his willingness to address difficult, painful issues, Mohsin is no catastrophist. Richard Lee caught up with him when he was in London. Richard, tell us what's so special about Mohsin.
Well, he's one of those rare novelists who not only looks at vital, important issues, but also does interesting things with the form. And he's done it again with Exit West. It's a fascinatingly constructed piece of work.
He wrote a piece in The Guardian about being a radical optimist.
Yes, and this is one of the things that he brings to the table here, because, I mean, we've heard so much about the migrant crisis, as it's called so often, and so many, we've seen the terrible pictures, we've heard the terrible stories of people's experience in that journey from the place of terror to what they think of as a place of safety. But actually, in this novel, he's more interested in the before and the after, and he actually comes up with a plausible version, or a believable version, perhaps, of some sort of future that might not be a catastrophe.
Well, let's hear Mohsin reading now from Exit West and also your interview with him. Then we'll be back to discuss the issues that it raises at the end.
The rendezvous point was in a converted house next to a market that reminded Nadia of her former home. On the ground floor was a dentist's clinic, long lacking medicines and painkillers, and as of yesterday, lacking a dentist as well. And in the dentist's waiting room, they had a shock, because a man who looked like a militant was standing there, assault rifle slung over his shoulder. But he merely took the balance of their payment and told them to sit, and so they sat in that crowded room with a frightened couple and their two school-aged children and a young man in glasses and an older woman who was perched erectly on her seat as though she came from money, even though her clothes were dirty. And every few minutes someone was summoned through to the dentist's office itself. And after Nadia and Said were summoned, they saw a slender man, who also looked like a militant, and was picking at the edge of his nostril with a fingernail, as though toying with a callus or strumming a musical instrument. And when he spoke, they heard his peculiarly soft voice and knew at once that he was the agent they had met before. The room was gloomy and the dentist's chair and tools resembled a torture station. The agent gestured with his head to the blackness of a door that had once led to a supply cabinet and said to Said, "You go first." But Said, who had until then thought he would go first to make sure it was safe for Nadia to follow, now changed his mind, thinking it possibly more dangerous for her to remain behind while he went through, and said, "No, she will." The agent shrugged as though it was of no consequence to him. And Nadia, who had not considered the order of their departure until that moment, and realized there was no good option for either of them, that there were risks to each, to going first and to going second, did not argue, but approached the door. And drawing close, she was struck by its darkness, its opacity, the way that it did not reveal what was on the other side, and also did not reflect what was on this side, and so felt equally like a beginning and an end. And she turned to Said and found him staring at her, and his face was full of worry and sorrow. And she took his hands in hers and held them tight, and then, releasing them, and without a word, she stepped through. It was said in those days that the passage was both like dying and like being born. And indeed, Nadia experienced a kind of extinguishing as she entered the blackness, and a gasping struggle as she fought to exit it. And she felt cold and bruised and damp as she lay on the floor of the room at the other side, trembling and too spent at first to stand. And she thought, while she strained to fill her lungs, that this dampness must be her own sweat. Said was emerging, and Nadia crawled forward to give him space. And as she did so, she noticed the sinks and mirrors for the first time, the tiles of the floor, the stalls behind her, all the doors of which, save one, were normal doors, all but the one through which she had come, and through which Sayd was now coming, which was black, and she understood that she was in the toilet of some public place, and she listened intently, but it was silent. The only noises emanating from her breathing, and from Sayd, his quiet grunts like those of a man exercising or having sex. They embraced without getting to their feet, and she cradled him, for he was still weak, and when they were strong enough they rose, and she saw Sayd pivot back to the door, as though he wished maybe to reverse course and return through it, and she stood beside him without speaking, and he was motionless for a while, but then he strode forward, and they made their way outside, and found themselves between two low buildings, perceiving a sound like a shell held to their ears, and feeling a cold breeze on their faces, and smelling brine in the air. And they looked and saw a stretch of sand and low gray waves coming in, and it seemed miraculous, although it was not a miracle. They were merely on a beach.
So how did you get started on a story of migration, or was it more that you realized you couldn't avoid it?
Well, when I moved back to Pakistan 7 years ago, one of the things that struck me was how many people said, "What the hell are you doing? You've made a terrible mistake. Why on earth would you move back?" And I guess that's not exactly what you want to hear when you move someplace. But also, I think that the pressure of people wanting to move, the strength of that force, really hit me. And at the same time, having just come from Britain, where I was becoming aware of the strength of the resistance to that force, I really felt the tension and conflict between those two things. And I wanted to explore that in fiction, and so I began to work on this novel. At that time, there had been no Brexit vote and no Donald Trump, and if you'd asked me, even last year when I finished this book, was either of those things likely to occur, I would have said no. But that ongoing, intensifying pressure of movement and resistance to movement has been there, and of course continues to be there.
Where did the voice come from, this kind of detached presence?
I was thinking how to tell this story, and in my first three novels, each of them has involved a kind of frame, and then a story inside the frame, and the frame is slightly skewed to the story, and the story is saying one thing, and the frame is suggesting something else, and in the conflict between those two things is an interpretive space that the reader gets to play in. This time I didn't want to do that. Maybe I'd been living in Pakistan for a while and speaking to a lot of people, you know, who would say things like they'd only read one book, for example, which happened to be one of mine or somebody else's, or they didn't really read books, or they read books rarely, or the kinds of books they read were different from the kinds of books that, you know, I read. And my father-in-law, who passed away last year, said to me perhaps a year or two ago, he said, you know, "You're basically a storyteller. That's what you do, and that's what people come to your work for. That's why it matters." Which is a very obvious observation, but isn't, because I thought of myself in a way as a novelist, you know, as a
kind of... Which is subtly different.
Yes, architect of books, a builder of chapters, a construction worker of sentences. I put, you know, letters together. And I remember thinking about this and thinking he's absolutely right. And so I wanted to tell a story that was just a story, that of course had different opportunities for observation, but wasn't a story pretending to be something else, or potentially pretending to be something else, but really was a story with its, which was saying exactly what it intended to say. And then the mode in a way, came to me from children's literature, where very often we encounter an omniscient narrator, but not the detached omniscient narrator of so much of 19th century fiction or even contemporary fiction, and also not the close third-person narration that follows a character's point of view but in the third person, but rather a kind of partisan presence, you know, a maternal or paternal presence that is related to the characters and is sort of on their side and also on the reader's side. And I thought that would be a very good way to tell a story like this.
But it's not a straightforward story in any sense. And where do these mystical doors come from?
Well, I think the emotional reality of the doors is already here. So in the novel, there are these doors, and people begin to step through them and emerge in faraway places. And, you know, over the course of a year, what's likely to be the next one or two centuries of human migration unfolds in, you know, 12 months or 24 months. Billions of people move. as I suspect they will move, but in at a much more compressed time frame. And I think that for me, technology has already created an environment that feels like these doors. You and I could speak over Skype right now, and we'd see each other if I were in Pakistan and you were in London. We'd see each other as if through a window. And either of us could open our phones and look at a screen, and our consciousness could be in America or on the surface of Mars.
Not only that, but I suppose that air travel is essentially
exactly.
a door.
Or, I was in Dublin yesterday and Manchester the day before and Pakistan the day before that and tomorrow New York City, hopefully. And it is like stepping through doors. So I think in a way, the doors were emotionally true to our technological present reality, even if not entirely true to the laws of physics.
We're familiar with the kind of terrible stories of the journey with bodies getting washed up on the beach and all that. Were the doors also a way of leaping over that to,
yes.
to focus on what happens before and then, more importantly, what happens after?
I think that's right, because the extraordinary nature of that story, the journey across the Mediterranean, the trek up from the Balkans to Germany, in a way, we think of that, and it's presented so often as the core story. But it isn't the core story. It's actually a very small part of the story. It's, you know, a week, a month, a summer.
Oh, 20 pages, as in your novel.
Yeah, exactly. And it serves to create an almost differentiating experience between the person making that journey and the reader. Whereas the bulk of the life, what led up to the move and how life was after the move, is shared by everybody, regardless of whether you've been a refugee. And I think is really the story. So the doors were a way to avoid the part of the story which I think gets so much attention, but isn't, tragic and horrifying though it may be, isn't the core emotional reality of what's going on.
You say that the doors are in some way reflect the kind of the doors that we all have in our pockets, the smartphones that connect us all together. Is this connectedness one of the forces that's driving these people who want to move so much?
Yes, I think it is. We are living in a world of increased connectivity. And that connectivity is taking many different forms because as we, through power of demographics and economics and technological change, radically transform our environment, as climate change occurs, as wars are unfolding and crops and traditional ways of feeding ourselves are disrupted, rainfall fails, people are moving. And they're also moving oftentimes with mobile phones in their pockets, able to communicate with somebody a day or a week or a year ahead on the journey. Able to see where they're going to, even before they leave. And so I think that our connected world is driving this change. But that said, it has always been going on. There would be no people in Britain were there not for migration. You know, if the last 5 centuries of migration in the United States hadn't occurred, it would be peopled by the Iroquois and Ojibwe and Sioux. And of course, the people we call the Native Americans are themselves not native. They are pre-Columbian migrants to the Americas. So I think that the reality is there has always been pressure on human beings to move. It is only recently, though, that it seems we think that that can be prevented and stopped and should be.
Your narrator is happy enough to specify the actual street on which Said and Nadia wind up in London, but he can't bring himself to name the city from which they come. What's this blurring of the past?
Their starting city is somewhat slightly out of focus. We can see it, but yet it could be different places. I used Lahore as my template for that city and subtracted, I guess, enough identifying detail that it could be read. I met an artist over the weekend at the Lahore Literary Festival who said she'd spent a lot of time in Syria and said that she was certain it was Aleppo that was being described. I've never been to Aleppo. But I wanted the city to be one that people from different places could have be their city.
So you strip out extraneous details like the name of a cinema or,
yes.
or a particular district?
Absolutely. And so, I mean, very often actually in my novels, generally speaking, I try to remove details, leave enough so that the imagination of the reader is hopefully being catalyzed and engaged, but allowing the reader to kind of make it their own, not over-describing things.
And that's reaching for universality, for saying this could happen to anyone.
Well, in this case, with the city, that's part of the reason for that. And there's a second reason for it, of course, which is I couldn't bring myself, even fictionally, really, to do to the city of Lahore what happens to the city. It would have broken my heart to write that. And also, I didn't want to contribute to a narrative of Pakistan going down this decline and winding up as some, you know, Talibanized, you know, ruined entity, because I don't think that is likely to occur. And I didn't want to produce a story which implied that it might.
Said's father asks Nadia to promise she'll look after him until he's out of danger, a promise that she realises is tantamount to killing him. For when we migrate, we murder from our lives those we leave behind. Is this emotional damage an unavoidable part of migration?
I think it is. If I think about why I don't leave Lahore now, I mean, there are multiple reasons to it, but the most important reason is my parents are getting older, and I like the idea of my children, their grandchildren, being in the same place as them. And I think there is a kind of emotional violence which occurs when you move, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't move. I've moved many times in my life. But it's worth remembering that people who come, who leave where they live and go to another place, are not coming without paying a terrible price. They are perhaps giving up loved ones. They're giving up music, culture, food, environments they're familiar with, relationships. There's an enormous price people are paying. And so if they come, they're coming because the reality that they're in is such that that enormous price is worth paying.
Does this connectedness through the internet, through the smartphone, does this connectedness help this kind of price, or does it make it all the more keen?
It's a tricky one. On the one hand, we certainly are connected in a way we weren't previously. There's a degree of connection. But it's unclear to me how much emotional power these connections really have. The day-to-day reality of a grandchild playing with a grandparent is very different from that weekly Skype call with these two old people you kind of know. And so it may be that, in a way, our connectedness is activating our nostalgia. It's sort of tantalizing us, but not really satisfying the need that it's supposed to be satisfying. It makes us remember what we wish to be connected to without making us feel truly connected.
The second half of the novel pivots from describing the horrors that are visited on your unnamed city to searching for some sort of hope. Is it easier to write a kind of dystopian vision of what might go wrong than it is to come up with some recipe for solving all of that?
I think at this particular moment in human history, a radically hopeful politics is vital. And the reason for that is there are times, of course, when a radically critical politics is vital, and it's always vital. I'm not saying that's not vital. But at a moment when there is a prevalent sense of crisis, very few people will say, nope, the way things are is, you know, pretty good. We're sort of happy with, whether you're on the right or the left or a nativist or a migrant or whatever your point of view is, people generally seem at the moment, anywhere in the world one goes to, think, you know, I want things to be different. In that environment, either we look to the future with fear and trepidation and then turn towards nostalgic political visions, projects of restoration that seek to take us to the past, you know, Trumpism, Brexiteering, cheering for the caliphate. Or we start to articulate genuine, new future realities that we might hope for. And so for me in this novel, it was intended really as a hopeful gesture. And I expect that we will see a lot of that in literature and the arts coming forward because we need it. You know, in the 60s, we saw so many interesting works of film and literature. Think of films like The Graduate, you know, Harold and Maude, films coming out of America that talked about breaking down the existing system and some, you know, something else more idealistic or better in its place. Well, I watched a film last year called Captain Fantastic, which is also, in a way, a very radical notion of how a family should live and how we should live in our current society. And this novel is intended as something similar.
You say that you were thinking of this novel, working on this novel for a considerable period of time, for a number of years, and then Brexit happened and Donald Trump happened. What does it feel like when the world shifts under a novel you're writing like that?
Well, it's very depressing. I wrote the first draft of The Rotten Fundamentalist before 9/11 happened, which completely changed that novel because my quiet fable of a man who leaves America and his corporate job and moves back to Pakistan, you know, grows a beard, became totally overshadowed by this horrific terrorist attack and then all the wars and conflict that followed. This novel, strangely, didn't change post-Brexit or Trump. It was sort of anticipating these movements, but just thought, I thought they would take longer to manifest themselves. I thought we were headed in this direction, but we might not arrive at this destination for 5 or 10 years. Instead, we arrived in, you know, 5 or 10 weeks. A sort of, you know, historical door opened up and we all stepped through. But oddly, these developments have made me feel very energized about this novel, because the kinds of conversations that, you know, we're having right now around it are precisely the kinds of conversations I want to be having in this moment. And also, you know, trying to find a way of communicating with people which isn't the purely binary left-right, you know, native-migrant argument. But instead, you know, what are some new starting points that might be universal? You know, for example, that we are all migrants and that the nature of being human is to be migrant. And if we can begin to examine the emotional reality of that, we might have a common ground from which to speak of migration that's a bit different from saying, you know, I hate foreigners.
Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianBooks to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Mohsin Hamid talking there to Richard, who's here now with Sian Kane and me to pick apart some of the issues raised in that interview. And there are loads and loads of things we could talk about, but I'm really interested in those doors and what they say about how fantasy tropes are being used by the new generation of novelists. Sian, you're a fan of Naomi Alderman, who's actually just made a hat trick of nominations. She's been nominated for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, the Orwell Prize for Political Writing, and the Wellcome Prize for Science Books. She's clearly sort of harnessed something here, hasn't she?
Yeah, well, she's kind of on the Venn diagram there with The Power, her latest novel, which tackles issues about feminism, which explains its placement on the Orwell Prize and on the Bailey's. And also she's got this sort of science fiction-y sort of genetic element to the book, where she's bestowed women with this genetic ability to shock people with electricity that they run through their own bodies, and it's linked to being a woman, and it completely changes the gender dynamic. So she's put this in there and just done some really clever stuff in terms of how she considers how pervasive the gender dynamic is now and how ridiculous it actually looks to swap it around. It really sort of brings into light how much we just assume is the normal way of things. And when you shake it up a bit, you realise just how weird our current situation all around the world is. She also looks at feminism all around the world. And so you see like the women in Saudi Arabia rising up and using their electrical powers for like huge amounts of destruction, because it's this sort of pent up frustration at being ignored for so long. Whereas there is quite a sort of staid and political discussion going on in America about getting boys to walk certain ways home to avoid the girl gangs and stuff like that. So it's super, it's just an incredibly clever novel, and you know, she deserves all of those prizes if she wins them.
So Richard, what she's doing is she's using electricity in the same way that Mohsin Hamid is using doors to open a place into a different reality.
To open a door, if you will, to disturb the life as we have it with something taken from fantasy or from science fiction. This is something that literary novelists have been doing for ages. I think of Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, or David Mitchell, who in The Bone Clocks was exploring fantasy ideas in a kind of literary way. But there's something subtly different here.
Exactly. It's different because they are using these tropes to take you into a literary world, maybe not a generic world. But these are people using these tropes to take us, to link us to political reality, the Orwell Prize.
It's a way of flipping out the world and exploring it as something slightly different. It reminds me very much of a novelist who was on the podcast at the end of last year, Aaron Thier, whose Mr. Eternity imagines a man who's 1,000 years old, so that he's got a lens through which he can see the slow change of climate change, which in fact, in geological terms, is of course terrifyingly fast. But it's a similar kind of strategy to take some way of flipping our world, which is fantastical or magical in some way, and use that as a way of exploring one of these complicated ideas.
And actually there's a novel that I've just discovered which I'm very excited about, which is another debut. It's Jaroslav Kalfar, who's Czech. Well, he's actually lives in America, but he was born in the Czech Republic. And his novel, The Spaceman of Bohemia, uses someone who's hurtled into space
with an extraterrestrial spider to look at how Central Europe is coping with, you know, in the capitalist world, in the aftermath of communism.
It's something that genre writers have been doing for years. I mean, that's one of the pleasures of reading science fiction or fantasy, is that you see your own world reflected through these altered lenses. But what I think is interesting is how literary novelists or writers writing for a mainstream audience now feel able to do so. Maybe science fiction or fantasy is just slightly more part of our culture. It's another tool in the toolbox.
Yeah, because I'm absolutely not a fantasy reader. Sean, you are a fantasy reader.
Yeah.
Do you think this is something new, or do you just say, hey, guys, this has been going on forever?
I think, yeah, it has been going on forever, but I do think that authors, I think, have adopted it with a bit more enthusiasm recently, because I think what Richard was saying before is absolutely right. There isn't really that nerdy shame of putting something that isn't real in a book anymore. And so we do have conversations that rise up, like with Margaret Atwood saying that she doesn't write science fiction, she writes speculative fiction, because she doesn't have talking squids from outer space in her books. And she had a very public fight with Ursula Le Guin about it. And Ursula Le Guin kind of rightly said, well, if you want to benefit from the body of criticism and work, you know, if you want to use these tropes, you've got to own up to it, and you've got to really adopt it and not talk about it with any sort of shame, you know? So I think that's new, the ability to talk about it and have authors like you have, you know, Mohsin Hamid, who's very well respected, doing this and not making an issue out of it like Margaret Atwood did.
And I think that's what's new, is we don't seem so surprised anymore. Nobody's saying, oh, but is this a fantasy novel? It's just part of our culture.
And a lovely footnote to the Calfar novel was that the very week that it was published, there was news of two billionaires being sent up on the first lunar mission for 45 years, and which is, so it's capitalism doing what the state used to do, which actually is exactly what he's doing. So I just think that there is something these novelists are doing. They are capturing the zeitgeist. That seems like a cliched thing to say, but what they are doing then has a physical translation into the real world at the moment, whether it's climate change or it's the empowerment of women or it's capitalism taking over the space exploration business.
Yeah. Well, we are living almost in a science fictional world now.
Yeah, post-truth world. Hey, here we go. Well, that's a good place to end. If you want to catch up with any of the books we've been talking about, and I do hope you will, Exit West is published by Hamish Hamilton. Spaceman in Bohemia is published by Hodder. The Power by Naomi Alderman is published by Viking. And Mr. Eternity by Aaron Thea is published by Bloomsbury. Next week, we'll be chatting about international literature with the Danish novelist Dorte Nors, who has just been longlisted for the Man Booker International Prize. In the meantime, if you like this podcast, why not try some of the others we make here at The Guardian? This month, we're featuring Token. It's a weekly podcast about marginalised identities in which presenters Leah and Freddie ask questions like, can you be an atheist Jew? To listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts, which is where you'll find us too by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. We're at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. For now, from me, Claire Armitstead.
From me, Richard Lee.
Me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian, who, as ever, is silent. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.